hearty greetings to all our Voice of America listeners. This is VOA's Sonny Young in Washington. Thanks for tuning in this evening. Welcome to the sunny side of sports.
Stand up! Stand up! Stand up! Stand up!
Friends, we can all listen to the sunny side of sports.
Yes, my friend.
The sunny side of sports.
Sunny side of sports.
The sunny side of sports show.
Great show, bro. This is Sunny Side of Sports.
Sunny Side of Sports. Right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
Stand up. Stand up. Stand up. Stand up.
Next week on January 17th, we'll mark what would have been Muhammad Ali's 75th birthday. The death last year of the former world heavyweight boxing champion caused an outpouring of tributes from around the world. As those tributes made clear, he was so much more than a highly skilled boxer. Ali was also a symbol of integrity, of black resistance, of second chances, and finally, of the health perils of a career in the ring. In the first of his two-part profile of Muhammad Ali for the Sunny Side of Sports, VOA's Adam Phillips looks at Ali's early career and its impact.
Muhammad Ali was born Cassius Marcellus Clay Jr. in Louisville, Kentucky, on January 17, 1942, to a poor family. One day, when Cassius was 12, someone stole his beloved bicycle. A white policeman named Joe Martin heard Clay crying and vowing to beat up the thief. On the spot, Martin offered to mentor the boy at his boxing gym downstairs as a way to channel his anger. In 1960, just 6 years later, Cassius Clay would win Olympic gold in Rome.
The most popular USA winner was the lighthearted Cassius Marcellus Clay V in white here, who easily defeated Poland's Zbigniew Patrykowski. Cassius Clay, the winner for the USA.
Legend has it that back in Kentucky, Cassius Clay angrily threw his gold medal into the river because of the racism he encountered in Louisville. Still, he was quickly snapped up by a small group of Louisville investors who sensed his promise, says New York University history professor Jeffrey Sammons, who doesn't really believe that Ali actually threw his medal away. But the author of Rebel with a Cause and Beyond the Ring, The Role of Boxing in American Society, says that all the hype around Cassius Clay was certainly real enough.
He becomes a Madison Avenue creation, a breath of fresh air. Boxing had grown stale. There were all kinds of issues with organized crime. They saw in this young, brash Cassius Clay someone who would make boxing marketable in a way that it once had been. He modeled himself on, in some ways, Jack Johnson because he talked to his opponent, but on the other hand, on Gorgeous George, who was this foppish wrestler who had all this shtick, you know, with perfume and blonde hair and effeminacy, etc., that he was the beautiful one. And, of course, young Clay referred to himself as beautiful but also as the greatest.
This is the legend of Cassius Clay, the most beautiful fighter in the world today. This I predict, and I know the score. I'll be champ of the world in 64.
This patter earned Cassius Clay the nickname the Louisville Lip.
Many people didn't think that he was for real, that he was more mouth than skill or talent. And of course, many of these opponents were not very skillful boxers or they were well past their prime.
As when, in November 1962, Clay fought Archie Moore in Los Angeles. The man fans dubbed Ageless Archie entered professional boxing 7 years before Clay was born. Clay accurately predicted before the fight, don't block the aisle and don't block the door. You will all go home after round four.
Ripping punches by Clay and Moore goes down. Cassius raises his hands over his head and it's all over. Clay wins by a fourth round knockout as predicted.
Soon bigger bouts were in the offing. Ali had won all 19 of his professional fights when he challenged Sonny Liston for the heavyweight championship of the world. Hulking and powerful, with a criminal record and alleged ties to the mafia, Liston accepted Clay's challenge. The fight was set for February 25, 1964, in Miami Beach, Florida. During the run-up to the bout, Clay continually taunted Liston to reporters, calling him a big ugly bear who even smells like a bear.
I'm handsome, I'm fast, I'm pretty, and can't possibly be beat. If you like to lose your money, be a fool and bet on Sonny.
When Ali showed up for the weigh-in the night of the match, the betting odds were 8-1 against him. Astoundingly, Clay vanquished Liston in the seventh round in a technical knockout.
Clay has won! Clay has won!
Then, the new heavyweight champion of the world does something else, perhaps even more dramatic. Immediately after the fight, he announces that he had converted to the Nation of Islam, that he was changing his name from Cassius Clay to Muhammad Ali. Cassius Clay is a slave name, he said. I am Muhammad Ali, a free name. It means beloved of God, and I insist people use it when they speak to me. Jeffrey Sammons says this frightened and angered many people.
Many people saw the Nation of Islam, or even Islam itself, as sort of a non-Western religion. So that made Ali an outcast. Someone said that they'd rather have someone who's identified with organized crime than to have someone identified with Islam, or in this instance, the Nation of Islam, which was known at that time by many as Black Muslims.
Although Nation of Islam leader Elijah Muhammad and his follower, the Black Power activist Malcolm X, both rejected the term, the Nation of Islam did portray whites as devils and blacks as racially and spiritually superior.
One of the things about the Nation of Islam is that it rejected integration. It believed in separation of the races, which ironically made it very popular with the Ku Klux Klan. Malcolm X actually met with Klan. It also resonated with someone like Richard Russell, who was a staunch segregationist senator from Georgia. And Russell was very supportive of Ali. So it just shows you there can be strange bedfellows in politics and boxing.
In December 1965, Madison Square Garden photographer George Kolinsky was still an amateur. He was in Miami when he spotted Ali crossing the street to the storied Fifth Street Gym, where the champ was training to fight Ernie Terrell the following March. Knowing that Ali was now one of the most famous and controversial celebrities in the world, Kolinsky decided to follow Ali inside, even if it meant using a bit of bluff with Angelo Dundee, Ali's trainer, at the door.
And I said, I'm the photographer of Madison Square Garden. At that point, I was only the photographer of my family. Angelo Dundee looked at me and he said, okay, comedian, come on in. So I went into the gym and I see Muhammad Ali working out.
What was it like to see that?
Pretty excited that I would be able to take pictures of somebody famous in an area that was pretty private. We had instant chemistry. We had, at least I had, the trust almost immediately in Muhammad Ali looking into my camera, and he somehow was trying to be good to me so that I would get good pictures.
The 8 pictures Kolinsky took that day did land him a photographer's job at Madison Square Garden. More important to Kolinsky, however, was that the initial unspoken trust he shared with Ali developed into a friendship that lasted a lifetime.
And that friendship was very, very important to me because, number one, I was able to get really great shots of probably the world's most famous-looking face. And secondly, Muhammad Ali, for all the brutality that boxing represents, also represented to me a beauty where he tried to be friendly and kind.
A current exhibit of George Kolinsky's photographs of Muhammad Ali at the New York Historical Society shows many of the softer sides of Ali behind the scenes. There are pictures that show him eating, washing up, or just clowning around. One memorable shot shows Ali napping in his hotel room between workouts. The muscle tone and gleam of his torso make him look every bit the champ. Yet one can also sense the all-too-vulnerable human being within. Of course, most of the most famous Ali photographs were shot in public, either in the ring, training, sparring with the press, or showing off to the public. Muhammad Ali was a fascinating subject, says Kolinsky, because everything he did radiated charisma.
Whenever you walk down the street with Muhammad Ali, walk into a building, into a lobby, whenever you walked into an area where there were a lot of people, everybody sort of gawked at him as if, wow, that's Muhammad Ali. How many people in this world have that charisma that he had?
Ali often projected an image of barely contained masculine rage. This was publicity gold. But Kalinske says Ali was actually the gentlest man he ever knew.
Not many people know, unless you were speaking to him in private, that he really spoke in private in a whisper.
In 1967, the United States was deeply ensnared in the Vietnam War. It was a brutal conflict which sharply divided the American public. Muhammad Ali was one of hundreds of thousands of young American men who were drafted. He refused to serve, citing the Quran's injunction not to fight in Christian wars. Further alienating himself from the white establishment, he told reporters he had no problem with the communist Viet Cong he'd be expected to kill.
My conscience won't let me go shoot my brother or some darker people or some poor hungry people in the mud for big powerful America and shoot them for what? They never called me nigger. They never lynched me. They never put no dogs on me. They never robbed me of my nationality. Raped and killed my mother and father. How can I shoot them poor people? I would just take me to jail.
According to Jeffrey Sammons, that's just what the government set out to do.
He's convicted of draft evasion, fined $10,000, and sentenced to 5 years in prison. Of course, there are appeals, but at the same time, the boxing authorities are also acting. They're removing his boxing license, stripping him of his heavyweight title, and his passport is revoked, so he cannot box anywhere. He can't box here, and he can't leave the country to box somewhere outside of the United States.
Ali then took to the college lecture circuit, where he got a sympathetic audience among students who also opposed the war, during what would otherwise have been the heart of his stellar boxing career.
So it's from 67 to 70 that he's not able to box and earn a living. He said, I understand it. I'm standing up for principle. You know, I can't sell myself out.
It took a lot of guts to do that, right?
Oh, absolutely. On one hand, where all of this hurt his boxing career, it made him into a legendary figure. It made him into a transcendent figure. And I maintain that that's when he really becomes the people's champ.
Muhammad Ali would go on to appeal that conviction and win that fight too, and ultimately reclaim his championship title. We will tell that tale and his later adventures in Africa, the United States, and elsewhere tomorrow in the second part of our feature profile of Muhammad Ali. For the Sunny Side of Sports, I'm VOA's Adam Phillips in New York.
Keep on sunny side, always on sunny side. Keep on sunny side of life. It'll help us every day. It'll brighten all our ways when we keep on sunny side of life. When we keep on sunny side of life.
Amazing, amazing. I expect, to be honest, I was confident to win this trophy. Was amazing, you know, when you work during the year hard, and of course when you win the collective awards and after individual, for me it's amazing.
That's Cristiano Ronaldo, the Portugal and Real Madrid football star, after winning another trophy Monday in Zurich, Switzerland. The 31-year-old Ronaldo won FIFA's Best Player Award for a fourth time, after Portugal and Real Madrid won both major European titles in 2016. Ronaldo also won the old FIFA award once in 2008 and in 2013 and 2014 when it was organized jointly with France Football Magazine. Argentine star Lionel Messi was second in the voting, and Frenchman Antoine Griezmann was third. Among those praising Cristiano Ronaldo in Zurich was his Real Madrid teammate, Croatian midfielder Luka Modric.
This year, he definitely deserves everything. He won two biggest trophies, Champions League and European Cup with Portugal, and he did great. He played great football, and he deserves all these awards that he is getting.
Also getting an award in Zurich was American Carly Lloyd, who for the second year in a row was named FIFA's best female player.
You know, I want to keep getting better. I know there's a lot of things I can keep continuously working on. And, you know, next year, this year is just the focus of helping my teammates and pushing myself and, you know, just going out each and every game and doing well.
Another FIFA award winner in Zurich was the Italian Claudio Ranieri, who was named Coach of the Year after leading surprise package Leicester City to the English Premier League title. Meanwhile, Leicester City's Riyad Mahrez is the subject of my latest Sunny Side of Sports blog post. I encourage our Voice of America listeners to check it out. The address is blogs.voanews.com/sunny. Once again, that address, blogs.voanews.com/sunny. I title my blog post, Mahrez, one of the marquee players at the Africa Cup of Nations in Gabon. Riyad Mahrez is going to Gabon after a nice run of recognition and success. Mahrez was recently named the Confederation of African Football's Player of the Year for 2016 in Abuja, Nigeria. The 25-year-old Algerian was also named the Professional Footballers Association Player of the Year and Fans Player of the Year. Algeria advanced to the quarterfinals at the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations before losing to eventual champion Ivory Coast 3-1 in Equatorial Guinea. Mahrez and the Desert Foxes of Algeria will kick off their 2017 Nations Cup campaign on January 15th when they play Zimbabwe in Franceville, Gabon. Three other venues, Oyem, Port-Gentil, and the capital, Libreville, will also stage matches during the 16-team African football showpiece. The Nations Cup final is scheduled for February 5th in Libreville. Joining us once again here in Studio 22 for a look at some sports social media trends is VOA's Doug Bernard. Welcome back, Doug.
Great to be here again.
What is trending in the sports world?
Well, there are two stories that are generating a lot of chatter on social media, Twitter, Facebook, etc. And I think we have to start with this one. It was the NCAA Football National Championship. Here's how big this game was. It just got a mention in the Senate confirmation hearings for Jeff Sessions to be Attorney General, and Senator Lindsey Graham called it the best football game he's ever seen.
Wow. Bipartisan support.
There you go, exactly. it had nothing to do with the fact that Clemson is in South Carolina as well, I'm sure. So it was the showdown between Clemson and Alabama, the Tigers versus the Tide. All throughout the game, the first three scores, first three periods, it was really looking like Alabama, who has been undefeated this season, was going to remain undefeated, and they were going to carry the day in this game. But in the end, it all came down to the fourth quarter and Clemson quarterback Deshaun Watson. Now, as I was saying, Alabama led the 45 minutes of regulation play up until the last 15 minutes. It was then, about 2 minutes into the period, Deshaun hit Mike Williams to draw within three. So that's a touchdown, 7 points. They draw within three. There was a run by Clemson running back Wayne Gallman. That put Clemson in the lead, and they wouldn't give it up again. Deshaun Watson again hitting Hunter Renfrow for a second TD pass. Tigers end up 35-31 at the end.
Wow, what a game.
It was a whale of a game. Just an amazing fourth quarter. So I will agree with Senator Lindsey Graham on that.
Now, Doug, I know this was the de facto national championship game, but the format has changed in recent years.
It has, Sonny. And, you know, it's changed several times over the many years that colleges have been playing these various championship-type games. Everybody wants to know who's the best. And, of course, if you look at a professional league like the NFL, it's all very regimented. Everything's kind of, you know, set down in stone. But the college football in the United States works rather differently. So since 2014, this it was its third year, 14, 15, and 16, they run what they call the College Football Playoff National Championship Series.
Okay.
Now, it's supposed to be like the NFL in that, you know, looking at teams' records and kind of putting them against each other. But there are so many teams that it just doesn't come down to a sort of a nice, orderly process. So in the past, most recently, there were always the AP, what they called the poll, AP judges poll. This was a group of professional sports columnists, coaches, that kind of thing. And they would rank the teams 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And people were always upset about that. Well, now what's happening is they're ranking the teams to sort of say, these are the top 8 teams, and they'll play it off, and then we have a national champion. But people are still getting all angry about that and saying, my team was left out, my team's better than that team, how could you not put them in the quarterfinals, et cetera, et cetera. So no matter what you do, I guess people are just going to kind of complain. So that and also very quickly, I just have to say, there was one Twitter is big having a big laugh over Clemson senior linebacker Ben Bulwar. That was his last game. He was obviously very happy. Clemson won. And as you know, every player gets a chance to hoist the trophy and, you know, sort of parade around with it a little bit. Well, Bulwar didn't so much hoist, I think, as maybe he needed a room. He was cradling it and kissing it and stroking it. And it went on for a long time. So Twitter's been having a lot of fun with that.
Well, Doug, you talk about the number of teams in this American college football tournament. I understand we could be seeing more teams at the World Cup.
You understand correctly. The FIFA Council has unanimously voted to expand the World Cup to 48 teams. Now, lots of people have opinions they're sharing. I'm just going to read a few of them. These from Twitter. Jonathan Liu says, well, I like FIFA's optimism that there will still be 48 countries in 2026. but more of them are along this line. Drew Haney writes, pretty upset about the decision to expand World Cup to 48 teams. Money is all they care about, and that's clear. Here's another quote. Mohammed El-Sawi, a 48-team World Cup is one of the most ridiculous ideas in the history of football. But it's FIFA's idea, so that's no great surprise. A lot of people, some people in places like Scotland and some Asian countries are happy about it because it's more likely now, more teams obviously going to be playing, and so they're hopeful to, you know, kind of nudge their way into the World Cup. But a lot of, I think, sort of traditional soccer fans, I guess, you know, they don't like, 36 seem like a lot to them, 48 just seems... Perhaps some of them are suggesting it's really kind of all about the money for FIFA. But, you know, we'll see. It's still...
I think the FIFA president, Infantino, has put forth an idea that the additional 16 teams would play in like a single elimination round.
I did read something about
that.
And
then we'd get quickly back to that 32-team format.
I did read something about that. There's you're more up to date on that. And there is a lot of confusion, people kind of putting out potential charts of team play and group this and group that. And it looks like some kind of, you know, electrical engineering diagram or something. But again, this is something that has been voted, has been approved. So it's something we will be seeing come 2026.
What else is trending out there, Doug?
Well, there is one story. This is a quick short story. So there is a mixed martial arts group in China. It's called WBK. That doesn't matter. They had a fight night Saturday in Hangzhou, China. And Russian fighter Ibrahim Khalilov was set to go up against Uzbekistan native Bakhtiar Baratov. So they come out from their corners. The bell rings. They go to shake hands as boxers or fighters do. You know, they sort of bump fists. And as the Uzbek native, Baratov, has his hands to go shake, the Russian, Khalilov, just hauls off, cracks him with a right arm. The Uzbek guy goes down, and the entire crowd goes nuts. Everybody's booing, you know, cheap shot, blah, blah, blah. And so the Russian, Ibrahim Khalilov, has been taking a lot of heat on Twitter. Some would say deservedly so.
Exactly sportsmanlike.
Well, no, but he defended himself and he said the bell rung before we went to go touch. Once the bell rings, you know, game on is how he's trying to defend himself. I'm not saying that people are buying it. I'm saying that's what it is.
Thanks, Doug. VOA's Doug Bernard. And that wraps up the January 10th edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. Thanks also to Voice of America producer Bill Werkinger. And thanks to VOA engineer John Dryden. And thank you for tuning in. I'm VOA's Sonny Young in Washington, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports.
I get it.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs Linda Thomas-Greenfield and Deputy Chief Executive Officer of the Millennium Challenge Corporation, or MCC, Nancy Lee, joined Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf and international partners recently in Monrovia to celebrate the start of power generation from the first turbine at the Mount Coffee hydropower plant, expanding access to power for people, communities, and businesses in Liberia. With U.S. government investment in the rehabilitation of Mount Coffee through the Millennium Challenge Corporation's $257 million compact with Liberia and other partners supporting the rehabilitation, the facility now provides an additional 22 megawatts of clean, renewable, and affordable power, doubling the amount of power the utility provides to Liberians. When all four turbines are commissioned by the end of 2017, the plant will quadruple the amount of power the utility provides to Liberians. We are proud to invest in the rehabilitation of Mount Coffee, which supports the government of Liberia's energy development agenda and puts the nation on a path to greater prosperity, Millennium Challenge Corporation Deputy Chief Executive Officer Nancy Lee said. Access to affordable and reliable electricity means students can study at night, hospitals can treat patients with better equipment, and businesses can grow and thrive. MCC's investment in Mount Coffee will help bring back online the country's largest source of power, providing much-needed electricity and driving down the price of power. Over the next 20 years, MCC's compact is expected to benefit 460,000 Liberians. The compact also seeks to improve inadequate road infrastructure in Liberia through investments in nationwide road maintenance. A strong road system will help reduce the cost of doing business, boost local trade, and create stronger economic ties throughout the region. It has taken a lot of hard work to get to where we are today. It has truly been a team effort with the Liberian government and with international partners, said U.S. Ambassador to Liberia Christine Elder. With the rehabilitation of the Mount Coffee hydroelectric plant, Liberians are a giant step closer to reliable, renewable, and affordable energy in their homes and businesses. More importantly, this represents the opportunity that Liberia's next generation deserves.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Tuesday on Health Chat, host Lenore Modou will discuss New Year's resolution, how to stay motivated and take some important prevention steps for good health in 2017. With guest Dr. Paul Jani Edo, Head of Clinical Services, Kosawa Polyclinic in Ghana. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call during the show, our telephone number is 202-619-3111. Health Chat this Tuesday at 1730 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, a discussion on the challenges of political transitions in Africa, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Tanzania, and Gambia, to name a few. Right here on the next Straight Talk Africa at 1830 UTC.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. VOA. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.